should I find everything? It's not so formal. The organizers asked me to lead a discussion on prospects of the heterotic string. I added the word string, I think, in there. It's not easy to know exactly what to do, and even if I knew what to do, it's a huge subject with lots and lots and lots of diverse pieces, some of which contend with each other, and others are very technical and others are very phenomenological. It wasn't the slightest bit clear to me what to do. So what I'm going to do is take a stroll down the lane of a lot of my own types of research, which will actually just be a marker for different kinds of topics that come up. And it would be really great to have discussions at any point about anything, and have no agenda that I have to finish. So it's really happy for people to just to talk about these in general. It started yesterday in Ralph's talk and can just continue it here. But be that as it may, I'm going to sort of outline it and control it by doing things that I think are of importance. And in particular, there's one particular thing that I would like to make a certain point about, and I'll discuss that in some length. Okay? So let me just start with the good old stuff. Smooth heterotic compactification. So Michael Rotz will cover undoubtedly a great deal of what's going on in heterotic orbifolds. That's an equally huge subject. And this is not to say that this somehow supersedes it or in any way. They're just different ways of approaching life. But I'm going to look typically at smooth heterotic compactifications here, though discussions can range anywhere they want to range. Okay. So we all know the story. We start out with a 10-dimensional string, or M theory in 11 dimensions, an extra dimension, and we're going to compactify on a 6-dimensional complex manifold, in fact, the Calabi-Yau manifold, to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry. We're going to typically do that where we have a non-trivial homotopy, but that brings up these interesting models that were introduced that have UNs in them. And we'll discuss that when we get there with Blumenhagen and Weigand and so on. And those are very interesting. It'd be nice to know the status of those things right now. But in any case, in general, I'm going to have non-trivial homotopy, so I can wrap Wilson lines there. I'm going to deal with slope-stable bundles. These are always going to be, in my context, SUN, except on boundary walls where they may split somewhat. And they will preserve supersymmetry. At the Penn Math Physics Group, over many years, we worked out how you compute the exact spectrum, matter spectrum, Higgs spectrum, and so on, from the sheaf cohomology of these bundles. It just depends on the various representations of the bundles that you're interested in. H0 gives you the gauge fields, and all the H1s give you matter, conjugate matter, Higgs, and bundle moduli. And we know how to compute those things, so that's nice. So using such technology and not having enough to actually lift that up, somewhere under the lectern at the beginning of the heterotic standard models. And there's a bunch of these, and I don't want to just exclusively and pedantically point to these, but these are ones that I'm familiar with and we can discuss in this general context. The thing that I want to, I guess the thesis of this part, is something Miriam always says, that the devil is in the details. And I must say that I completely agree with this remark when it comes to doing smooth heterotic compactifications. It's hard enough to get the spectrum right, and I will discuss models where you do get exactly the MSSM spectrum with right-handed neutrinos. But that's just, as far as I'm concerned, that's just where the game begins. Then the details start, and they're really hard. So I want to discuss some of those details as we go. Yes?
Very stupid question. What is the distinction between Higgs and matter in this setup?
Well, one of them is that these guys are coming from end V, which is somewhat different and have to do with how one moves a smooth, non-standard embedded bundle around. So those are my bundle moduli.
Well, Higgs and matter, is it, does it refer to the MSSM Higgs or to different Higgs fields?
It's just the gut Higgs, right? So if you had an SO10 model, one is a 16, the families of matter is 16.
to the gut Higgs?
Well, I mean, you then break it down with Wilson lines and get something else. You got the Wilson line in the book.
I would say that it is simply this, that you're going to get vector-like pairs of things in principle that come out of wedge 2V. And these things, we will, in the low energy limit, without prejudice as to where it came from, identify as Higgs-Higgs bar or pairs thereof. Anyway, heterotic standard models. There are several ways of doing this, but there are not many. So in the world of huge landscapes of 10 to the 500 vacua, it is an amazing thing how hard it is to find vacua that are even remotely like the real world. It's just true for what it's worth. I'm going to consider first SU4 bundles. That's one way to do things. If you have SU4 bundles, then you break down a spin 10 from E8. And then, since I'm allowing non-trivial homotopy, we will pick a particular Z3 cross Z3 homotopy. You can pick others. This is the simplest one that's going to give you the right kind of spectrum. And this is work we did back in 2006 with Braun and Yang-Wei He and Tony Pantev. And there's been recent very beautiful work on this also by the Oxford group. So that's one way of doing these things, and I'll discuss that a lot more in a moment.
Second work is on projective spaces, complete intersections.
Yeah.
And monad constructions.
Someone talks about standard model, how standard?
It's exactly the same. It is a SO10 model that's broken down to exactly the standard model, plus a U1B minus L. It has 3-6 beams, one Higgs pair, and nothing else. So it has three families of standard model particles.
It comes through SO10-16s. But they're using monad bundles. We used extension bundles and whatever, so there's different kinds of constructions. But the approach is very similar.
The one Higgs pair is generic in the moduli space, or is that a point in the moduli space?
Absolutely not. I mean, there's lots of things to this that we haven't done, but if you look at a generic point in moduli space for that model, it has no Higgs at all, and then we've tuned to get one.
Yeah.
What we're doing in that stuff is we're actually not particularly interested in one. We're trying to scan for lots of models, and then we would look for one that would be generic.
Unlike the amazing Pantev, Override, etc. model, which does have a generic Higgs-Higgs bar, it's the only one that has that. Though, you know, it's got its own problems. But so that's an interesting point. And there is a problem if you're not generic, because you can then grow a very large mu term unless you know how to suppress it. But, you know, the devil is in the details, so we'll discuss the details.
Does your amazing model have a symmetry that prevents the mu term?
I should not have used that term. It'd be on CNN for sure. What is that?
Does your amazing model, which you said generically has a pair, does it have a symmetry that protects against the mu term, or is it just an accident of algebraic?
It's just that it's generic algebraically that you will only have one pair of Higgs-Higgs bar. It doesn't depend on where you are in the moduli space. So it makes a difference. Okay, so there's also another model that came out about the same time, which goes through SU5. And this is Denagi and Bouchard. And if you go through SU5, you can break that down if you use a Z2 Wilson line directly to the standard model. It does not have the extra U1B minus L in it, which you might have thought was a plus, but we'll see that. That's one of the discussions I'd like to have. And again, I have no axe to grind here at all. I just want to look at the details a little closer than we've historically looked at them. So both of these theories, and maybe there's others out there, contain the exact matter spectrum of the MSSM. There are no exotics in there at all. And they all have one Higgs pair, H and H bar, no exotics. And in addition, this is where I think the details begin, and I just find this interesting, so we'll see what people have to say. We now know that we should have three right-handed neutrino chiral multiplets. And we also know that we have to have something like matter parity or R parity to prevent rapid nucleon decay. And this is the detail, because in general, you may not have any right-handed neutrinos. Saying what I said up here, that's prior to right-handed neutrinos. So where did the right-handed neutrinos come from? And then how do we know that we have a matter parity, a supersymmetric matter parity, to forbid rapid proton and lepton-violating things? And I wanted to discuss that, and I'd love to hear your comments. So let me start with these SU5 models. first thing you have to do is get rid of dimension 4 operators for different decay. Well, sorry, let me talk about identifying right-handed neutrino first. There was an interesting thing, again, the Penn group had found that if you're building these models, and this one in particular is an elliptic vibration over a DT9 base. That sounds very technical, but there was a really good reason for doing this. Elliptic vibration is a vibration with a base, but a DP9 is also a vibration with a base, a P1 base. So it's a double elliptic vibration. And you can use the Lorentz spectral sequence, which will allow you to easily compute any cohomologies, sheaf cohomologies that you want. And the way that works is you start in the full space, and you project them down with the Lorentz sequence into the first base, which is DP9. And then you project it again a second time with the Lorentz spectral sequence onto a P1. And there you can just count off what the dimensions of the representations are. So what you get is a grading. You can take any sheaf cohomology in the full space and grade it with respect to two Lorentz spectral sequences. We call those PQ for the first one and ST grading. These are important, as I'll discuss in a minute.
Is it generically elliptically fibered with DP9, or do you have to be in a specific space point in
modular. So luckily David is here. I didn't think I had to be. I think it's generically elliptic fibered.
No. But there's a very large family of elliptically fibered ones.
Yeah. We certainly use, we're at a, in a way, in a place where we did elliptically fiber. So when you do that, what it does, it starts making identifications of fields where you thought there were no identifications. So, for instance, we get a whole bunch of moduli, the V tensor V star H1s. They just all look like moduli, but they're graded under the Lorentz decomposition. So, in fact, some of them have no grading, and some of them, I hate to put a quantum number on it because it's really not a discrete symmetry, but you can put a grading on it. And by doing that, you can identify some subset of these moduli and say, oh, those are going to be my right-handed neutrinos. Normally, you have 50, 60, 70 moduli here. It's usually on order of 100 divided by the size of the finite group that you're dividing out. So you really have a lot of these. So it's not, those are the only things that could be right-handed neutrinos, and there's 50 of them. So what are you going to do? Well, one thing you can do is use the Lorentz spectral grading to try to pull out a subset, and you're going to call those the right-handed neutrinos. And what you have to do then is show that those right-handed neutrinos are allowed to couple to a Yukawa coupling to the rest of matter. Most of the time, they will not be allowed to couple. But every once in a while, if you work at it hard, you can make it couple as a right-handed neutrino. And Miriam and Ron and others, Bouchard, did this. And they were able to find, and as I know it, and you're here, you can correct me, there was one, they were able to get one right-handed neutrino, one graded vector bundle modulus to couple as though it were a right-handed neutrino. Do you remember how many?
Yeah, two. I think we were so really excited to see that actually vector bundle modulus could act as right.
Could couple.
Type coupling.
Right. So that's a very important point, whether it's 1, 2, or otherwise. Generically, when you do SU5, all you get is vector bundle moduli. You have to have a way of identifying what you call a right-handed neutrino, and there have to be, you know, three of them. I don't know the phenomenology entirely. Maybe you can have more which rotate around the right way, but be that as it may, you have to identify some. You certainly don't want 50 of these guys hanging around.
Well, you have only two left-handed neutrinos, right? You have only two left-handed neutrinos. Now they couple to vector bundle moduli, and vector bundle moduli act as Dirac masses, right?
Why? I have two left-handed neutrinos?
No, three. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. All right. That's why
I was silent in the room.
The
question is, can they couple through Yukawa couplings? And the answer is, not easily, because you need them to couple as right in right-handed Dirac terms. So they have to have the right grading. However, you have to get rid of the rapid proton decay as well, and these all play against each other. So as far as I understand it, one can get rid of dimension 4 proton decay and fast lepton violating operators, but it's then very hard to get the right grading on neutrinos. I thought you had one, maybe you have two. Nobody's ever, as far as I know, done better than that. But before I get to your question, let me just say that even if one was able to do this grading and to get that to work out, which I personally don't think you can, there's lots of troubles that follow from it. You have to so restrict the bundles to get the right grading that you find that most of the other cubic interactions in the superpotential vanish. So, for instance, you can find that all of the down Yukawa couplings are disallowed. That's frequently what happens. So you may get the right-handed neutrino to couple. You may get rid of dimension 4 operators for proton decay, but you don't have any down masses for anything. That's a standard result. So it's a complicated and difficult story. Furthermore, if you don't use a DP9 base, you can't do this grading at all. Yes?
Yeah, I'm just trying to recall, in our case, what we were surprised is actually that we did not get our parity violating terms at the cubic level.
Well, that's not a surprise, right? Because it's built in somehow.
Well,
that's my point.
No, the point is that we actually get quark masses, but we didn't have charged lepton masses because they were in the same class of our. That's our parity violating terms.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So you didn't
lepton
just leptons, or which ones didn't you get?
Quarks are massive, mm-hmm. but the charged leptons remain massless.
Mm-hmm.
And neutrinos have Dirac masses by coupling to vector bundle.
How many neutrinos couple? How many did you identify?
Two.
Right.
Can I ask, are all these couplings perturbative at this stage?
Yes, yeah. Because that's the only thing we can calculate, which right. is a co-product of three cohomologies into C
yeah,
numbers.
Right.
So we used filtration and, and those were results at what we call classical level.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So the dimension 4 operators, higher order couplings beyond three linear couplings are zero at the classical level, right? By definition.
That's not.
Yeah.
Because you cannot. If you do the classical calculation of the couplings, it's super.
Yeah, I mean, the one you
it's
normally write.
It's a product of three cohomologies.
That's what you normally write down, but there'll be higher order corrections, so there'll be higher order interactions.
It's I'm talking classical level, right?
Yeah, but that's enough.
Well, in the superpotentials, we well know there are no alpha prime corrections, right? Right, we know that all Wittgens work. Right, so the only corrections would be coming from quantum cohomology calculations, worksheet instant on contributions, which is very hard subject.
Oh, yeah.
Even those could kill us, and we could generate potentially our parity violating, three linear couplings, which we don't have at classical level, but they could be there at this worksheet instant on level. But nobody knows at this point how to calculate it for the specific type of.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand the
statement.
Must have 303 right-handed neutrino and must have matter pi. Is that the requirement from phenomenology?
No, that's a requirement out of my mind. So you have to ask the experts here, and it'll be actually maybe there are some in the audience. I mean, there are supposed to be three right-handed neutrinos, one per family. If one were writing models, that's what you would write down. Now, whether you can actually have 10 of them and have them mix and then diagonalize and that will work out and be okay with phenomenology, I am not sure. Does anybody know whether one can play that game?
Yeah. Zero is possible, right?
I'm sorry?
Zero right-handed neutrino with small arbitrary violation, that gives you neutrino mass.
So are you saying it's possible to work out scenarios in some other building?
You know, CISO is one of the possibilities, but just one of the possibilities. I think this is restricting the model really narrow origin by hand. I think it's a
too much distinction as a first thing.
Yeah, no, the point is well taken, and I absolutely am not the expert in any of this, and so it would be nice to know exactly what the options are. However, all I'm going to state here is, and then I think I should move on, is that at least if I was writing a field theory down, I would normally have thought that I would put in right-handed neutrinos, and probably three of them, one per family, to get these three massive neutrinos. And I might have thought that I would just put those in. I could either try to use a seesaw mechanism or not, in the cases I'm going to talk about, we're not, for a reason. And then you would also want to have matter parity. You certainly don't want large violations of dimension 4 operators, and certainly dimension 5 either. That's sort of a standard scenario, and all I'm saying here is let's try to invoke that in these heterotic standard models. Maybe I should leave it at that.
Can you just comment, because you know this vector 1 moduli to play a role of right-handed neutrinos.
That's what I'm saying.
It's reincarnated in F theory context too. That
yeah.
Natural way, the way they give neutrinos masses.
Right, but it also has its share of problems, and these are the problems. Whether one can get them right or wrong or otherwise, you get many vector bundle moduli, usually on the order of 50 when you divide by Z2. And then how many of those are going to be, can you identify some as right-handed neutrinos? If you want them all to be right-handed neutrinos, is that a limit?
You calculate your color couplings and you see which couple, right?
That's
in a particular setting, two couples.
My point, Miriam, is that which ones couple depend entirely on the internal grading of how you build the bundle. Mm-hmm. So they don't just all couple or not couple. It's a very distinct question. This is not, Luray spectral grading is not a discrete symmetry or a global symmetry. It is a stringy symmetry, but you don't have any choice. So you'll find that none of them couple. Maybe you can make one or two of them couple, but then all the right-handed, then all the sleptons can't have a mass, for example. Yeah, I'm not saying otherwise. I'm just saying that you have severe restrictions here, which at least I have never been able to make work. There is, but, yeah.
More remedial question.
Yeah.
How generally are you studying these vector bundles? When you say this or that is hard to do, have you picked a very special kind of vector bundle that you're then analyzing? Or?
Yeah, we're picking, to be sure, we're picking vector bundles, in this case by extension, because that's the only ones we could get to work, which give us exactly the matter spectrum of the MSSM. And those are unbelievably special, so they're very, very limited number.
And what you'd like to do is just write down a general vector bundle, compute these couplings, find out what linear combination of moduli coupled with my
But it wouldn't mean much if you had 11 families and 17 HH bar pairs. And that's what always happens. So again, I'm nothing against the landscape, but toiling in the fields of anti-landscape, it's amazing how difficult it is to find bundles that are the MSSM.
Let me just try and ask a more technical question, which is, are you studying a class of vector bundles which is very special, or are you now able to control just a general solution of the Donaldson and Ulibeck-Yau equations?
Yes, that's what we're trying to do. I mean, we've not got as far as any of these guys, but that's exactly what we're trying to do. So we just take a complete class, and for us it's monad bundles over classes like the Yau-Sinusoids. And then we just carpet bomb them, right? We just look at everything and try and see what you get. And basically, you know, for example, try and get to see which ones are standard bundles and which ones would have these couplings.
And you're talking about the most general vector bundle on a given manifold?
No, it
doesn't mean much, almost, that
state. The Calabi-Yaus are tip of the iceberg, and then on that iceberg, there's a tip of the bundle.
Yeah. So he's, I'm sorry?
Right, just to say, within the monads, do you find many three-generation models?
That was all I was going to say. I mean, at the moment, we're running scans that run over tens of billions, and at the moment, we're down to 8 possibilities, and that number will go down.
For three generations?
For three generations.
So monad is the same as these linear sigma model constructions, basically?
The linear sigma models are a special type. Yeah, but it's very similar.
Just one other comment in relation to this. I mean, I think the point Bert is making that is independent of construction is that if you want to do an SU5 model, you've got to find some neutrinos. So you need some mechanism, and I think he's going to discuss some other mechanisms besides this Luray sequence, but you need to be able to sort of distinguish your vector bundle moduli through some means.
Okay.
That distinguishing moduli, I think, is very important. Anyway.
Can you ask one question? How much do we know about the super potential that govern bundle moduli? I mean, maybe a lot of them are lifted.
That is a really good question. So if you wait a little, with a little luck, we'll get to that. That's a very important question. But right now, I'm doing the bare bones basics here. Okay. Okay. So there are other ways of doing this kind of thing. One was Luray's spectral sequence. There is this very nice idea which comes from these people originally, and I wanted to discuss their work with a little later on because they really have this beautiful idea of how to get standard model without Wilson lines, which I think is a very important idea. But based on their work, there was work by Watari and Ratu. It's a similar kind of thing. What you want to do is you have all these right-handed neutrinos in SU5, and you'd really like to identify some of them as neutrinos, and then you'd like to see if you disallow B and L violating qubit terms. Not easy to do. So what these guys have done is they say, well, we won't look at SU5 really. We will look at a decomposable bundle where it's just S of U4 cross U1. If you look at such a bundle, then in fact you find that the commutant inside of E8 is SU5 cross an anomalous U1. It's all similar to type 2, but this is in a heterotic context. Okay. Now this U1 anomalous, then it splits up bundle moduli into two types. Those that are really moduli and have no charge under the anomalous U1, and those that have a charge under the anomalous U1. And those guys, you could try to identify as the right-handed neutrinos. And then, in fact, you find that you indeed can produce Dirac couplings with those. And using that U1 B minus L, you can eliminate B and L violating at least qubit terms in the superpotential. However, it has its drawbacks, like everything else I'm going to talk about here today. But it's not matter parity. It just doesn't have the quantum numbers of matter parity. So you can, in fact, get rid of dimension 4 operators, but apparently, and they would have to speak for themselves, but what their papers seem to say is that they have trouble at dimension 5, that they generate generically pretty large dimension 5 operators. Furthermore, they never presented an actual realization. You have to give a Calabi-Yau and you have to give a bundle which has these properties, which they did not do in that paper.
I'm very much confused about higher dimension operators. I thought at the classical level, if they enter superpotential, they're all zero. It's only Borsig instantons that can potentially generate them.
Well, first of all,
so when one talks about these higher dimension operators, right?
Well, that's not,
you have control over them yet.
You have to be extremely careful, I think, what context you say this in. So you take the Luray spectral sequence stuff that context you were working in. That does not apply to higher dimensional operators. You simply have no idea what happens because Luray spectral sequence, which I may get to at some point, is a cubic product of cohomology. So what happens is you take a cubic product, it's graded, and you find what part matches to the complex numbers. When you do that, you find that, therefore, certain cubic products are just disallowed by this grading. However, it only applies to cubic products of these things. You go to higher products, those things could all exist. There's absolutely no reason for them not to be there. They're not set to zero. They can regrow anyway. They are simply not protected by PQST. No, that's true. The PQST has nothing to do with them. It's not a discrete symmetry. It grows back. That one point I'd like to make is that if you get supersymmetry breaking in soft terms, those soft terms are absolutely uncontrolled by that kind of Luray grading. A very important point that I'm heading toward. Any case, this was a very interesting paper. And I must say, given the discussion we had in here 2 days ago, where people are saying, you know, there were U1 anomalous theories, it's true. This is one of them. And it is true, I think, when I read carefully what Watari did, that he was aware that he could take his U1 and that he could probably deform it into an indecomposable bundle, into an indecomposable SU5. He does not do it. But he does give a footnote where he mentions it. So I just wanted to give him credit for understanding that he was looking at the tip of an iceberg, which is the iceberg is what Laura was talking about on Monday.
Excuse me, please.
Why is this U1 anomalous is always B minus L? Is it not possible to get Peechy-Quinn symmetry? Like in F theory, we were able to construct models with Peechy-Quinn symmetry. So it immediately forbids proton decay, Bayer mu term. So why in heterotic model it's not possible to get this U1 anomalous to be Peechy-Quinn symmetry?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I can immediately answer you.
I think that, you know, it could be, this doesn't have to be B minus L.
Then if you have a chance to get Peechy-Quinn, why don't you study that? Because that's a beautiful thing already, forbidden many things.
Yeah, but then you may get just absolutely wrong spectrum of neutrinos, because this thing is cooked up to give right-handed neutrinos that can couple with Yukawa couplings. So they all come in two pieces. First, identify the neutrinos so that they can form Yukawa couplings. And second of all, then you look at various operators like B minus L. I'd like baryon lepton violating operators, and whether you can do all of them at once is a good question. And that, and generally, it's doing several things at once that's hard.
Can I just come?
Sure.
I think it is possible to get to do the Peechy-Quinn thing. It's just it depends on the concrete analysis of the Higgs vector, which has not been worked on yet. But since the group theory is exactly the same as NDF theory, I think the same. And also, just since you mentioned it, but
yeah.
So there do exist three generation models of this type, with exactly three generations of the standard model.
Of what type? Watari's type? I know what you guys did, and I will get to it. But
so, but on a concrete, it's not that these are harder to get or anything.
Well, I don't know. He didn't do it. Here's it. Right, but even with you, we'll talk some more. Because I love your models, but I don't care. But it's very important. We have a thesis, and we will discuss it. We discussed it on Monday. We'll go further. Anyway, I want to point out that there's another way to do this, which is the old-fashioned way, which is to simply find Calabi-Yau's with isometries, put bundles on them that are equivariant under those isometries, and get a spectrum which then carries a representation of this isometry, and that you can try to choose to be exactly R parity. And we can give examples of this thing, but giving examples that are remotely realistic where the bundle is stable is very difficult. So Lara and I are trying this. We're optimistic one day and not optimistic the next, but that would be pure R parity. So when all's said and done, yes?
Maybe I could come back to this discussion of right-handed neutrinos, because
sure.
I'm a little confused. Because if I understand it correctly, at the moment, we have only massless states.
Yes.
Now, in the usual seesaw, neutrinos are heavy. They're typically of the gut scale. So I think that is a question which at the moment, at this level, cannot really be addressed. So the only thing I think which one can do is one can look at the symmetries which you have for the massless states. And then either you have, say, a B minus L, an effective B minus L symmetry,
mm-hmm.
and then you can talk about massless right-handed neutrinos
mm-hmm.
forming Dirac masses. Or you have to discuss dimension 5 operators. And then the question is, what is the lepton number, the relation of the lepton number violating dimension 5 operator and the ones which give you proton decay?
Mm-hmm.
So that is, I think, the question. And the question is whether in these constructions you have these options, that you have either constructions which give you low lepton number violating dimension 5 operators, or you get some and you understand why the coefficients are small.
Right, so I'm not sure quite how this, if this exactly fits into your statement.
I'm very confused.
Yeah. Right, no, but all we're talking about is the zero modes. We really are. So we're looking at these models, and we're looking at the zero mode spectrum. However, a point that has to be made incredibly clearly here is that this is exactly the MSSM spectrum with some moduli, no more, no less. So for instance, there are no other fields, exotic singlets, for instance, to which neutrinos could couple to form a mass, to form a seesaw-type mass. So things that are normally done in generic theories where you can add fields to it or coming down from some gut which may have other fields, or for that matter in heterotic orbifolds which have a bigger spectrum, that simply, absolutely, abjectly cannot be done in these heterotic standard models. And that's part of the issue here. Now we do break supersymmetry, we do generate higher order operators, which I will discuss. But I think the starting point is, no, I only have these fields, that's all I have, I can't do anything else, then how realistic can I be? Well, I think Michael was.
Can you get this LH operator? I mean, if you have just standard model spectrum.
You can always. You can always, under these circumstances, rotate that one away. So that's not a problem. I'll get to the ones that.
It's a good operator, right? It just gives you a suppressed between masses. And do you get it or not?
I'm not avoiding you, but let me move on for a moment.
It's not renormalizable.
Yeah.
All those things are worksheet suppressed. I have to reemphasize, the only thing you can get classically at most is triple, is three linear superpotential.
Yes, yes.
All the other terms, if they are there, they are worksheet suppressed and the stream skills.
Yes, but they're not protected. What I was saying to you is they're not protected by, for instance, Luray symmetry. So that if you think you've gotten rid of certain problems, those problems can regrow at higher order. That's why I want to make.
You would suppress it if I take the volume large, right? Those are worksheet suppression things. You are in this geometric limit of rather large volume.
Well, let me
so
continue.
I don't appreciate this point because I think in this limit, you can really hope that you can go to space of Keeler moduli where worksheet instantons would be highly suppressed and all these non-renormalizable terms would be highly suppressed.
Could be and could be not. And I will get to this in a little while. You have to be extremely explicit. The one thing which is true, the one thing that is true, Miriam, is it depends on the kind of symmetry that you're trying to disallow terms with. So PQSD symmetry only applies to cubic cohomology. If you break supersymmetry and start getting soft terms, let's say after you integrate out moduli, there is no reason at all that those terms have to satisfy those symmetries. They can violate B and L all over the place, and these things can regrow very dangerously. And I just leave it at that, and you have to see what models you can build. Anyway, these are various ways one can try to solve these problems within SU5 context.
In the MSSM, there are only few U1 symmetry you can find. U1B, U1L, U1B degree, and U1R, only four of them. And U1B and U1R allows the LLHs. But U1 L and U1B degree disallows LHs.
Yes.
So, and U1 anomalous must be one of them, you know, because you must have U-car copy.
Yes.
So that U1 anomalous you have must be U1B plus L or U1B degree, I think, because it's. Those are the anomalous combination.
Okay, that could be because I have not looked at any of these.
It's probably disallowed.
Okay. But let me get to the model which I think just trumps all of this stuff and just gets rid of any of the problems, which is what the one thing I do want to emphasize here. I do not work on these SU5 cases. There's lots of ways to the SU5. I mentioned a number of them. I think the devil is in the details. You have to get right-handed neutrinos identified. They have to be able to form some kind of masses one way or another. And you have to make sure that you don't, in making them couple to something, kill the couplings of other things. You've got to make sure when you break supersymmetry that it all doesn't re-arise because it really wasn't the symmetry that you were using to protect the dimension 4 operators, because Luray symmetry is not a symmetry. There is one case which, let me just point out how far you can go with it, where you don't worry about any of this stuff, which is if you go through SU4, pointed out by Ed Witten a million years ago, and it still makes sense to me. Let's have an SU4 bundle that breaks E8 to spin 10. We will do this on some Calabi-Yau, elliptic Calabi-Yau is a Z3 cross E3 isometry. So we've produced these in these standard models. And this breaks spin 10 down to the standard model gauge group, but as is well known, it produces an extra gauged U1B minus L. And the reason that happens is that it's an abelian Wilson line, and the rank of spin 10 is 5, so it preserves the rank. So I have to get rank 5, so you need an extra U1 to do that. And it's possible to move that around, so it's not distinctly U1. It might be mixed. However, you can, in fact, choose the Z3 so that you get exactly an extra gauge U1B minus L. And that's what I'm going to stick with. Now, this is nice in a way because it contains explicit Z2R parity. So if, as long as the theory is U1B minus L gauge invariant, it's not going to grow any rapid proton decay or lepton number violation. On the other hand, we don't notice the photon of this floating around this room, so it has to be broken somewhere spontaneously. And it had better be broken above the electroweak scale, otherwise we completely pollute all known electroweak physics. So there's a real question as, okay, you can do such models, but can you spontaneously break this U1B minus L? It's much easier said than done. Before I do it, let me just look at the spectrum of this thing. A key point, which was my comment before, all we can do in the heterotic string is break the 248 down under whatever the background bundle is going to be. So we have an SU4, so we can look at the tensor products of the SU4. That's the decomposition. These are the only fields that can occur, period. Although I would love to have other ones around that might, for instance, carry 3B minus L to be even. So if I gave it a VEB, I could break B minus L. I can't do it because they're not there. Very important point. That's only true in these heterotic standard models where you get nothing but the MSSM spectrum. So how many of these do you get? Well, again, we figured out how to do this from the cohomology of this. You look at those H1 groups. You can find out how many 10 representations there are. If you then put in the Wilson lines, you can do the same thing again, but you look for the Z3 cross Z3 invariant piece of the sheaf cohomology, and you pull that out. And what you get when you do all of this is precisely three families of quarks and leptons, each transforming in the usual way into 3-2-1, and each having this last number as their B minus L quantum number. And as is well known, you always get three right-handed neutrinos coming out of the 16, one per family. So that's not an issue for us here. Those things just happen, and they're separated out from everything else. They're not moduli. In addition, you do get one pair of HH bar Higgs and Higgs conjugate fields. They do not transform into B minus L, which is a good thing, as we'll see. And so we get exactly the matter spectrum of the old MSSM, plus these three right-handed neutrinos. And in addition, we get vector bundle moduli. These come out of END. We get very few of them here, fewer than any other model I know. But we still have 13 of these guys, and they're just extra fields, completely uncharged, just floating around. You better stabilize them, and how you do that's the question. Now, I want to look at this theory in a little more detail. You have supersymmetric interactions, and they turn out to be precisely the Yukawa couplings for up and down of everything. But the B minus L just forbids these dangerous baryon and lepton things. So they're just gone by U1 B minus L. It contains R parity, and it just kills them.
Yep.
Well, let me state that in a minute. There's several. Let me get to it in a second. Let me just finish the. Oh, maybe that is a good time to do it. The original part of this theory had an anti-brain. We want an anti-brain. Let me just point out, I always differ with your terminology. This is completely globally defined. It saturates all anomalies. So if I look globally, meaning everywhere on the collabial and in the 11-dimensional space, this is well-defined object. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's the exact equivalent of the KKLT kind of vacuum. It has an anti-brain in it. If you ask whether we have proven that there's a stable minimum of the moduli with an anti-brain in it, that's another story. But that's nothing to do with consistency.
There's warping which made the anti-brain light, so it was in effect as one thinks a spontaneous breaking of the SUSY.
Yeah, so I haven't examined this in the depth that I want to. It is certainly true that these things are five brains wrapping some curve. And as the volume of that curve gets small, the tension gets small. So at least a priori, you can always take the tension of these things to be small. So a similar issue to what you just said is, be that as it may, if I write all the moduli here, is there some natural reason why I should expect that I should live at a region of small volume curve? And the answer is, I don't know one way or the other, but I don't think it's as natural as it is in other cases. I have no problem with it. We did it on purpose, Miriam. It is globally consistent. It's got an anti-brain so that we can lift a deep negative cosmological constant up towards zero, a la KKLT. It does exactly the same thing. But if you ask whether indeed these things are going to be stable because you're breaking supersymmetry explicitly, the answer is you got to do a stability calculation of the whole thing, and it's still not clear whether it's completely, we can find stable minimum of the moduli.
So okay, is that configuration connected by moving into an E8 wall to some kind of bundle that just isn't...
You could connect it. You could connect it. That's right. We've never done that, but there should be a small instanton transition.
So then at least around that point, you could actually see it as spontaneous breaking instead of explicit and try to use supersymmetry.
Well, it would be an explicit breaking in the gauge symmetry sector as well. You'd have basically an anti-instanton on the when you dissolved it.
So it wouldn't be just the D term in this language of Laura's talk from Monday.
I wouldn't have. So the M5 brain theory is certainly not just a D term, but it looks so damn close that I don't want to really make it. Yeah.
It's a good question, and but it is globally consistent. I mean, it's.
Can I ask you another question? That
yeah, sure.
There's this idea of sort of hiding the Higgs by letting it decay into other decay invisibly, say by having extra singlets around. Mm-hmm. So you're aiming for the MSSM period, nothing else.
Well, that's the rules we set, right?
Yeah, but what if, you know, it seems like these models with extra singlets, I guess it's called the MMSSM or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, might be natural in this context because there are lots of moduli. So, are there examples of that that people have looked for and found? Or?
The answer is I don't know. Okay, I'm so myopic on these types. You can certainly write other models. What I want to show you here, I guess that's the thesis, the one thing I do want to express today, is that if I don't do that, and if I stay exactly with the MSSM, absolutely minimal, with absolutely no other matter multiplets whatsoever, I think you can get really good physics out of it, which is actually LHC, perhaps, maybe verifiable. And so I really don't want to start changing the MSSM. Let me show you what I mean, okay?
But is it the norm that something we are in string theory, we have a sloppy language? I mean, you also have some bundle moduli, you have also Kähler and complex structure moduli.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if people do pure field theory, they really don't have this kind of moduli.
Yeah.
So N MSSM is something with some singlets more, and we always have several singlets more.
I know, but these singlets do not...
Sloppy.
These singlets, well, I don't think we're any more sloppy. I think we know exactly what we're doing. It's the thesis I want to make. The difference, we have things that we know come out of that cohomology, and we know what they are, and we can give them names, okay? And I know how to write the non-perturbative superpotential, and the perturbative superpotential. Question is, how far can we go getting a non-perturbative superpotential? I think it's all incredibly well defined, but I want to give you a thesis here which involves this. Let me try this, okay? This is a recent work with my student Ambroso. I want to stay with the MSSM exactly. Any form of it will do, okay?
Yeah. New parameter.
Mm-hmm.
In these other examples, you put vector one or moduli to get that and it acts as giving new parameter.
In your case, it can, but not in ours.
Mu is zero, shift is zero in your case?
It is at the level you're talking about. So in the case that Laura and James did and the one you're doing, you have one Higgs. You generically have no Higgs. in bundle moduli space, but on some co-dimension, higher co-dimension surface, you grow a Higgs-Higgs bar pair. Nothing wrong with this.
And at some but, point, two pairs, actually.
Whatever. But whatever, it, what it's telling you is that you move off that surface, that you must grow a mass for the Higgs-Higgs bar, which is exactly the statement that there's a cubic coupling to the vector bundle moduli that grows it. So if you can control the size of that, then you can get a nice mu term, and you may well be able to. But generically, one would worry that it gets large, because these things often are large, in which case you have a mu problem. The reason we pursued the MSSM the way we did is because we did not allow that. We asked for generic single H bar. So we do not at the turbative level, have a mu problem.
So it's not a logical question. That just why you
have a mu problem. Not having mu parameter isn't.
It comes from Guidici, Massiero. We have lots of ways of doing it. But it's not a problem, whereas I think in those other models it's a problem. Yes? Yada?
No, I just think the other motivations as a mu problem is just that they haven't seen anything. So
right.
Maybe indicators isn't.
So let me try this, because this actually excites me and see.
Wow.
You get really from very matter spectrum right at the neutrinos, because you have the memory of SO10, right? So you have Yukawa couplings, right, of this matter. At the classical level, those couplings are there, the neutrino.
Yeah.
Because they are classical, I mean, I'm shooting myself in the foot, but because those are classical couplings, how can you make them really, really small?
Great question. And so,
so
to what extent these are related, the fact is I do not know any way, shape, or form in doing the pure MSSM to get a seesaw mechanism which would give a naturally light neutrino. So we're just going to make Dirac neutrinos with small Yukawa couplings, and how I make an electron, you know? Yeah, like an electron, 10 to minus 6. This isn't the biggest thing in the world. I mean, I'm short, but that's really short.
There isn't an all of order one, right? That's what I'm confused.
Well, that's, let's.
You know.
I know, but then we should.
Classical, this is order G.
Miriam, yeah. Then we have to give a whole theory for how to.
Zero, and then you know, only half of this order,
Miriam.
Right?
Miriam, let me do this, because this is a standard problem, a classic problem. I don't know how to predict the electron mass, okay?
See what issues are here, right?
Yeah, I know. I hear you. But this is the same problem everybody's going to have. Otherwise, you have to give a direct theory. It's true if you use instantons, you might try to argue that you have a theory for how you grow these. And I'm very sympathetic. I think that's an interesting thing. But then again, that's one way to do it. But for many, many, many years, as long as I've been alive, we put in Yukawa couplings and we'll just stick them in. And that's what I'm going to do here. Now, why the neutrinos, which are really small?
You calculate them and you have done that, which is great.
I'll get to that. We can calculate them. But I will never get there, so let me get there. These are all really good questions. But let me, this is the one thing I want to say. Let me say it, okay? There's some interesting thing you can do with a pure MSSM. Here's what you can do, okay? There is a moduli sector. There's a hidden brain. You can get Gugino condensation. You can get non-perturbative effects on the moduli. Let us assume, and we can get back to this later, that one can stabilize the moduli and break supersymmetry. And we're going to integrate those out so that we come down to a low energy effective theory, which is these zero modes, which is exactly the MSSM with three right-handed neutrinos and no more moduli because they got heavy and they're gone. But what you do inherit when you do that are soft supersymmetry breaking interactions. And the structure of those is incredibly well known. And yes, there are more general cases, whether it's D-type breaking or F-type. But here I'll just take F-type breaking, and I'll just put in the ones I'm interested in. There's new soft neutrino masses. There's soft Higgs, and I'm putting in the right-handed neutrino mass. There's the HHB coupling, and so on. Up at the compactification scale, let me call it 10 to the 15, 16 GeV, you get such parameters arising when you integrate out. Generically, they are absolutely, totally a function of the modulized stabilization problem, which I don't know how to do. So I am just going to allow myself to choose a reasonable set of soft parameters and see what happens. However, at the end of the day, and I think this is good physics for string physics, were I to be successful and produce a model which matches LHC phenomenology, you could come back up to these soft terms and ask, can I stabilize moduli in such a way that the breaking pattern is exactly the one that I get, which I'm measuring at the LHC? I think they really get close. There's not much slop in this system. So let me just show you what we learned here.
Yeah. That you're doing non-minimal sugars. Super, right? Yeah, this is parameterizing soft mass parameters, right? The way one does phenomenologically and stuff.
Right, one may do this, but one never did this.
But I thought you are doing that. Those are parameters you're putting in because you're not really, probably you're not able to calculate this stuff. Right? So you're doing M sugar here, right?
I think I just said what I'm doing. Should I try it again?
It's
no, but just doing M sugar sounds so little.
Just maybe you could.
Well, I did, Miriam. Look, this is no big deal, and it's not rocket science, and I don't want to push too far. What's happening here is I'm saying that you can get string vacua with real moduli and real spectra, and the spectra is precisely the MSSM with three right-handed neutrinos, and that's it. Not easy to do. You can do it. Then one could look at the stabilization problem of moduli, and one must. We are, but it's hard. But let me assume that we can stabilize all moduli somehow with various mechanisms and expand around those points. What that will do, it's not just MSSM, it does give you the MSSM with a pattern of soft breaking terms. Now that pattern is very much determined by what the moduli of the theory are and how they're broken and so on. And that's what I want to discuss. Is it possible that there are some patterns or a wide range of patterns which give really interesting low energy physics which is testable at LHC? And I claim there is. Yes?
So my question is, so right here, I think you're doing gravity mediation. You're getting these from the masses from dimension six terms.
Yeah.
So one really interesting question from the bottom up, where you would need something like string theory to answer it, is in such a scenario, why are the flavor problems voided?
Yes.
As opposed to engaged mediation.
Yes.
So even if you make assumptions, can you somehow justify the assumptions that solve flavor from your collabial specifically?
Yeah.
I mean, is that something that you're doing or you're thinking about?
It's something that I think about, but all I'm going to do here is say, you see, there's a real problem. Let me state the problem first, then I'll go back to that. The real problem is I have an extra U and B minus L. I don't have a hell of a lot of fields around to break it. I only have the MSSM to break it. Can I break U1, B minus L in a way that's consistent with electroweak physics? That, to me, is a very important problem, and as far as I know, that has never been done in the literature. Now, how you get to that point, and what that involves with the string theory and the flavor problem and minimizing moduli is really important to me. I'd like to know if it works first, and then we'll see how to proceed. It's a thesis. Anyway, it's shocking that you can break U1B minus L radiatively. Yes, sir.
Maybe just a comment to that question.
Sure.
I think since you start, your theory somehow knows about an SU4. So you start from a decomposition of the 248, which gives you 4,16 and 4 bar 16 bar.
Mm-hmm.
So this SU4 may in fact be something which, when you calculate the kinetic potential, may help you to get rid of these flavor changing.
There may be a flavor symmetry from there?
Yeah.
That depends on exactly how the cohomology classes arise, whether there's a symmetry between
them. But I mean, maybe that is something which one
could try to do.
Could try to
do.
Where are the different generations coming from in this again? They're just
the number of generations? Yeah, it's H1 of V and H1 of V star. One is generation, one anti-generations. And what we do is we set the second Schirn class to zero. They're chiral, so
and get three. This is for acts on these.
Well, I don't know where flavor symmetry would come from. It's a good question. Full disclosure, I'm simply taking the off-diagonal mixings of everything and just setting them diagonal, because otherwise I would be more insane than I am. But how that really arises out of string theory, I don't know. But I don't see any reason why you cannot compute it. You know the whole string theory. If you stabilize the vacuum, you can do it. But I just want to see, after doing all that work, whether you get anything that's interesting. And I claim you do. Okay, so let me show why you do. I'll go quickly here. Everything runs. We have three right-handed neutrinos. I claim that under reasonable assumptions, you can actually make one of, at least one of, the right-handed neutrinos turn over. Now, they carry no quantum numbers except B minus L, but they will spontaneously break B minus L. So using only the right-handed neutrino, there are no other singlets, there are no other 3 times B minus L even fields, all of the stuff of guts, all these brilliant models people had, they're not allowed here. So you got to do this with a right-handed neutrino. So I look at the renormalization group of the right-handed neutrino, and I want to run it down. And what are my starting assumptions about what's happening with that pattern of soft breaking operator? Well, I'll do the usual stuff. Basic universality here. All the squarks will be the same. The Higgs will be the same. We'll let the leptons left and down be the same. But I'm going to detach the right-handed neutrino guys. And then you say, he's doing something wild. But actually, they're very close to each other, it turns out, at the end of the day. But if I mildly let it be different, I will be able to get a right-handed neutrino, and I'll tell you why. So if I then scale down under these assumptions, I find that the third right-handed neutrino, which starts out positive, turns over and becomes distinctly negative. No question, I get a vacuum expectation value. Okay, and you can be a little more general than this. Now, you'd have to ask, can such conditions occur for moduli stabilization? As people have been asking, the answer is, I don't know, I haven't done it. But if you get these, which are almost the universal conditions, it's just that I am allowing the right-handed neutrino to have its soft mass float a little bit. Then, in fact, it turns over. I don't have time here to show you why, but it's fairly easy.
One or all three?
I can get. Yeah, so. Well, I did it concretely myself for one of them. So you can have two of them not turn over and one turn over. However, you can get at least two to turn over. I don't know if I can get all three to turn over. Okay, and these are all, this is, and I'm not just talking here. This, a year at the Institute of Advanced Study in a cave was required to get these results. But they do work, and we now have great generalizations. It's all on a computer, and I want to show you the computer plots.
So yeah. That's a fundamental problem. Then you break spontaneously after it.
I'm sorry, say again?
You break then spontaneously also R parity.
At the electroweak scale.
Yeah, which is a disaster.
Well, that's what I'm, exactly why I'm here. I have talked to various people, and most people say spontaneously breaking R parity near the electroweak scale is okay. I shouldn't break okay. it. That's what I'm told. So, I am told by various people from Gramaros and Ibanez, you cannot break it high, that's for sure.
Well, I know you can't.
Right, and you surely can't come low for other reasons, but there's supposed to be a nice sweet spot in between where it's perfectly good. It suppresses operators enough. This is where the phenomenology comes in, so let me just let it sit there and just show you what we get, okay? What we find is that, yes?
When you're saying M neutrino is not equal to M other sub-breaking.
Oops, going the wrong way here, sorry.
When it's not equal, what is the concrete number when you, of boundary conditions?
Yeah, so the...
M's neutrino relative to other submasses.
Yeah.
What is it?
Right. Well, I could tell you exactly, but I can't go backwards. So... The answer is, Miriam, we have computed every single number and every single thing. And so what happens is you compute the right-handed turnover. Then you look at,
I don't care about that, I believe you, Bert.
No.
But you're solving couple first order differential equation numerically.
Right. But then there is...
Asking the boundary condition.
What boundary condition?
Putting at 10 to the 16 GeV.
I showed you.
No, you haven't given me the number. You said it's not equal to this.
Well...
When you see this turnover happening in the infrared.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. So what happened? Okay, I don't have it here. I'm happy to give a technical seminar, which is what is required to do that. The point is that I next have to turn over the electro weak scale. B minus L turns over first, and the Higgs still don't turn over. Go down a few orders of magnitude, they turn over. Really important point involved here is that the right-handed neutrino does not carry electro weak quantum numbers, so it breaks on its own. The Higgs don't carry B minus L, so it breaks on its own, and it's only some more or less higher order things that they begin to attract each other. That's why one can get a hierarchy at all, otherwise they would have just clumped. Yes, I think so. Nobody I know, I've given this talk many times, and I have never heard of it before. My problem always was that, did we really have the MSSM? Because we had the S extra U1 B minus L.
Well, I just mean, never mind string theory. Is this a new?
Yeah, as far as I know. Yeah. Nobody's ever told me otherwise, but I don't care if it's new or not. We've done it here, but as far as I know, it's brand new. We've searched the literature to death. And the reason it happens is just what I said. Now, in fact, if you look at the renormalization group, you'll see what happens. If you don't have a right-handed neutrino, and you don't have B minus L, all of these equations have what people tend to call script S, which is the sum, it's the trace of the hypercharge times the soft masses. And that drives the electroweak turnover. When you put B minus L in, you get a second one of those. Let's call it S prime. It's almost the same. It's the trace of the B minus L hypercharge M squared. It's all zero, except down at the end where you let that neutrino be different. And the minute you let the neutrinos not necessarily cancel against the other leptons, you find that S prime now drives it, and that's what turns over the electroweak, the B minus L symmetry. So there's a distinct and clear reason. When you put it all together, Miriam, the bottom line is I can do it all, compute all parameters, and get the ratio of the B minus L mass to MZ. And I find I get a natural expression for hierarchy, depends on tan beta, depends on another parameter which comes from the Gugino mass. We work in a regime because of our approximations between 6 and 10, which is a pretty good one phenomenologically. And we put this guy in a middle region, which gives a reasonable Gugino mass, which I'll show. So we tend to get a hierarchy between 15 and 100. Actually, when we do it on a computer, we go between 2 or 3 and 2 or 300. So you can move in this region. I am told, Wilfred, that when you're just above the electroweak scale at a factor of 10 or so, it's not a disaster and it's okay, but I can't personally guarantee that. Okay, so we include that there's a natural hierarchy here between B minus L and electroweak breaking, and the B minus L boson mass would be between something like a TeV and 10 TeV. So already you have these things. The beauty is that you can actually compute all squarks, leptons, and Higgs from this, and we have some new data here, so let me just try. So this is my student just sent this to me, yet to be checked, but what happens is we'll get some initial choice of parameters similar to what I showed you, but we'll plot in the mu tan beta plane. And prior to cutting stuff out for squarks, Higgs, and so on masses, we get a region where you can't break electroweak symmetry and another one where a hierarchy develops. And I don't have that data yet, but there's a hierarchy in here. It changes as you move as to what the ratio of the vector boson masses is. If I demand that all squarks and leptons be above their presently observed bounds, you get cut to this region, this green region. If you instead demand that Higgs be above their bounds, you get cut to that one, Gugino's, that one, put them all together, unchecked raw data says that you actually have a region, this brown, dark brown region, where you have an electroweak hierarchy, you've broken U1, and all squark and lepton masses are above observed ones, but they can get pretty close to it. They also have an ordering to them. So it's not impossible to me that LHC could start seeing the bottom of these things, and were they to see an ordering, maybe that's significant. To make it a little more detailed, here's an example. Oh, I had that little arrow, which I won't be able to show because I can't go backwards. Ooh, great. I pick this point. There's a point right in the middle. Let me compute the spectrum there. And you can do that And there's the spectrum of all this stuff. Squarks are heavy, sleptons lighter, Higgs are these, and this 92 apparently is allowed, but I wouldn't want to hold my breath. There's a lot of discussion about the lightest Higgs. But these can be up or down depending on where I move in that space. The point I want to make, and God knows I'm not a phenomenologist, and it would be great if people ran with this a little, is that out of heterotic, smooth heterotic compactifications, one can get the exact MSM spectrum with three right-handed neutrinos and an extra B minus L. Radiative corrections will allow you to break the U1 B minus L and then the electroweak scale within a nice hierarchy of each other. When you do that, you then find that you can satisfy in some reasonable range of mu and tan beta all the bounds on all of these particles and Higgs, but some of them can be pretty close to the bounds. And I, for one, would love to massage this more and more and talk to experimentalists about what one might see here and what actually might be a signature of this process and what might be more general and not really of this process, and whether there are any lurking disasters that I don't know about, which would be better to know sooner rather than later. But people don't seem to have a problem with this.
Calculated the lifetime of neutrino?
No, I haven't.
Sounds stable.
Yeah, I don't know. This is all I know. Okay, and general for, I'm sorry.
So you assume neutrino mass to be explained by very small U.
Mm-hmm.
So the actually R parity violation is really, really small, even though it is broken at the electroweak scale. So neutrino may have a really finite lifetime. I mean, there may be some displaced particles, and that may be interesting.
I see. So that's a possible signature of such a thing. Okay, I just throw it out there. And I would say in general, I mean, I must say, I guess I'm going back to my childhood here. I started physics doing stuff. I thought this was physics was, and I've been toiling in the fields of mathematics for a long time. The beauty is there's a connection between all this, I think. Now, lots of other models must have very similar kind of things that one can say, and it would be nice to hear more about that and to see whether LHC can actually unravel this and start going backwards. It's true that it's not directly string theory. Where it becomes string theory, let's say they measured this, and that meant that it really is a U1 B minus L all the way up the compactification scale. But then what this is really measuring is the pattern of soft breaking. String theory, can you, by non-perturbatively fixing the moduli, get that pattern of soft breaking, or is it disallowed? Or is, in fact, is that the one that you would naturally predict? You'd have, I think that there is a threshold where you move over into moduli and string theory and they're related. Anyway, it is what it is. You will all make your own decisions here. Way down at the bottom, and not meant to be, I wanted to mention, now that I'm finished with my little pep talk here, is that there really was at least one really interesting different approach to heterotic model building of Blumenhagen, Muster, and Weigand. And I don't know the literature well whether they have pursued this or not. But that was a very interesting thing. One of the problems that we generically have building any of these models is to find Calabi-Yaus that have isometries, but even worse, to put vector bundles on them that are not just invariant under the isometry, but equivariant under the isometry. It's really hard, and that's why we get very few of these things. These guys realized that if they had an SU6, which breaks in each AA to the standard model, but they went to, I don't know, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but they had an S of U5 cross U1, and so that they really got standard model cross an extra U1 anomalous. And they play with this as various things you have to do. But they were able to get exact spectrum of the standard model from this thing. And no Wilson lines, because the U1 does what they want. Now, I don't know if there are, you can discuss whether there are or not problems with this and what you think the forecast of that is. But this is, I think, for people like me, that's a nice thing if you can work in that direction. These things do somehow look like those boundaries of stable bundles that Laura talked about on Monday. So there is a relationship between them. So are there any comments that you or Timo would like to make here?
Can I say what the problem is, so to speak?
Yeah.
The same as an F theory, basically, that gauge coupling unification will be an issue, because one has to make sure that the U1y remains massless. And then there is a very similar pattern of splitting of the gauge couplings as in the F theory approach. I think that's probably fair to say that by Wilson lines you can remain gauge coupling unification, and by U1y flux or whatever flux, you will probably have a distinctive
right? Still, if you say it, I don't know.
So it's a problem, or I don't know. What a problem on that one.
How about at the lab? Well, I wouldn't consider that, you know, this is not in conflict with experiment.
No, it's just aesthetically.
So the issue is, I think, more, did you look at the Yukawa couplings? Because that's something you can do and see if the pattern makes sense, right? If you get classical large neutrino masses, then you say, okay, it fails at this level, right? Or, so...
Sure, but you are not, you're just doing the model centering, probably obvious idea, you're not really looking in depth. That's sort of saying it's very much the consequence, which is quite good and done.
Has anyone followed up on your paper? Has anyone?
I mean, of course, the hypnotic Omnifold people were using surely when they were trying to understand what kind of bundles they have sort of hidden in their Omnifold fixed point and they make them blow up. Mm-hmm. And then they find that there are actually one bundle as well.
But you know, the original paper here is not the 2006, there's one earlier paper that's from Gulenko by Kansas.
Yeah, I just want to mention.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. What do I know? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Actually, I have a different question. When you mentioned these various possibilities of the U1s, are there really various possibilities because you have to embed it in the V8? Are there various choices you can make, or in the...
I'm sorry, in which context the X
U1? You was mentioning that instead of like V minus R symmetry or R parity, you could have different choices. But if you really start from the V8 symmetry and you have to have the U1 inside, do you have really the different choices?
I think you have the choices of the kind Laura was talking about and what these guys are doing. The boundary of bundles will allow you to have extra U1s in them, and those will persist even inside. But that's the only way I know to do it other than U1 V minus L.
And also just with Wilson lines, I mean, where you put the Wilson lines, I think you can put something in
touch. Miriam, can I do 10 minutes and I'll just rapidly... I don't want to bore people to death.
Can I ask you about the textures in this context?
That's the first That's where I am.
So back to neutrinos.
I don't want
to
go back. I want to go forward. I want to move forward. These are the textures. I have textures on the next slide. Yeah, what do you want?
Just because that's the first thing you do want to match as well as you can. And I would like to jump ahead going to neutrinos. Because if you have Yukawa coupling of that type, at the expense of shooting myself in the foot, you have of order one neutrino coupling, of order G neutrino coupling. There is no way you can tune this away because it's there classically. And experimentally, that's excluded. So how do you fix this issue?
Well, you're trying to argue to me, I think. And I really want to get through textures here. You're trying to argue to me that only instanton corrections could possibly produce a theory of the masses, let's say, of the electron and the muon.
No.
Well, I think that's what you are, because normally you just put in a Yukawa coupling, and we don't know where they come from. You put them. No. I mean.
Rock masses, right?
Yeah, I know, but unless you go into some business of flavor symmetries, and you know, I don't know. Tony Z was one of the people who did these first. There are certainly ways that people try to get textures of hierarchies of Yukawa couplings. And that's all really interesting. And I'm going to show you how to actually compute these Yukawa couplings so we could decide whether they're big or not. Okay? But before saying that, let me just point out that ever since the standard model has been around, people put in Yukawa couplings. They know they're small, but they don't have an obvious explanation of why they have the values that they have. And I don't think we should be asked to do that either. Now, if you can give one in terms of instantons, that would be great. And that's best I can say. Very quickly, I don't want to keep people here forever. textures. You can get textures. Again, this Lorentz spectral sequence gives a texture. I've discussed this before. So we could, for instance, get a very light first family and two non-vanishing, heavier, not light families. But these anomalous U1s do the job. And since Lara did this, I will forget all of this and just tell you that Lara showed you that if you take a bundle, which has, let's say in this case, an SU3 connection, an indecomposable connection, that one can wander in moduli and vector bundle space and get to a boundary where, in fact, the structure group changes from indecomposable SU3 to S of this, and hence you grow an extra U1 at the boundary, and this will be anomalous, and these things get into the ballparks of the things that you guys talked about and what Rattari was talking about. However, our point of view is that these arise in good old smooth heterotic compactifications. They just happen to be, when you have a bundle, it can decompose on supersymmetry walls. These walls are really interesting, and I won't say anything more about it here, Lara said, but what they do is they take the region of supersymmetry, here's where a bundle is stable and you have N=1 supersymmetry, and they put a completely calculable, through D terms, wall outside the line of instability here. So this actually has cosmological things you can talk about. It also tells you why nature could pick supersymmetry, because in fact it just falls down a wall until it becomes stable and the D-terms vanish. So that's useful. I, at least, was unaware of the existence of these massive walls bounding supersymmetry. So that's what we call a wall of stability. I think that's an interesting concept. I can't help myself but to say that the context in which you did it is not the same at all as the context in which we do this, and we should continue to discuss it later. The only one that's close is the stuff that Ralph did and the things that Watari did. I mean, you make that statement, I'll make mine. We can talk later. But the point I want to make is that you get textures from these things. And the reason is you get that U1 on the stable wall. I'll just flip to it. Let me be on one of those walls. I write all the matter. The matter is the Fs and the F bars. Those are 27s. But there are moduli. Most of those moduli don't have a charge, but these C's carry a charge. They're charged moduli. If I write the most general cubic term, I get this. It's already restricted by the fact that it has to be U1 anomalous invariant. On the wall, all of these C's vanish because that's what defines being on the wall, and you discover that you get an amazingly constrained Yukawa texture. The beauty is that as you move away from the wall, it turns out there are branches, as Lara discussed, but a very nice branch is when you move so that C2 is not zero. What happens is, yeah, you had this really restricted guy, but as you move away, these are spontaneously breaking U1, which is already broken because it's anomalous, but this spontaneously breaks it some more, and you grow back extra Yukawa terms. You can grow them back. And as long as these are near the boundary, you actually get a hierarchy. So if you like, these would be the biggest, these would be smaller, but there's a lot of stuff that doesn't grow back. So there's stuff like this. So you really get a complete texture in two ways. Some stuff is not allowed at all, and some of it might be more massless than others, okay? And that kind of thing happens. Yes.
Is it clear how far one can move?
Yes, it is, but we have to discuss it privately. We know exactly, in fact, in our papers we give the bounds on it. But here's the point, that even if you move into the middle, you can apply holomorphy, and the exact texture I just showed you will be true everywhere in the interior of a stable region. The hierarchy will disappear. So you can get a hierarchy near the wall, but the texture is true everywhere. It's very nice, okay? And you can extend.
The point again, those are all non-renormalizable terms you're writing. So I think in the context again of large scalar moduli, those are only virtually suppressed.
The normal argument for that, I believe, is that those you normally don't get such corrections because such terms would depend on T. And then you would have an axion shift symmetry forbidding it. None of those terms depend on T.
Okay.
maybe a
minute. Yeah,
just so that this motion is consistent with Cajun variance.
Just as a comment, what we're writing down there is just what's consistent with Cajun variance.
Right.
So
but
you
no,
don't
just
actually
it's
know.
Classical versus quantum calculations that you can do in the context.
But I was just going to say, in the stable region, these terms could totally be there.
Yeah.
Simply because you just by writing these verbs, you're just writing down what's allowed. So, you know.
So it would be a cubic coupling in the stable region.
Yeah, it
and
would
in
be
fact, you can write down examples where it
from
is.
Super fields, right? That is higher dimensional, right?
So
not necessarily in
no,
the stable region.
In the stable region, they actually just come from cubic coupling. And this is just an explanation of what they're coupling.
Times C,
C cubed.
It depends on the background that you're compactifying on as well, and this changes within the stable region.
Let's continue later. One thing which is apropos of where these U1s come from is that we can do a lot more in heterotic theory because you can find stable smooth bundles when you get to the boundary breaks into two extra U1s. You get two anomalous U1s, not just one. You can actually find stable region which has different walls that are bounding it because these smooth vector bundles have a whole structure of boundary supersymmetric walls. Each of these has an anomalous U1 on it, and they actually communicate to each other, so you get even more intricate texture. Some of it's very dangerous, and some of it is really interesting. You can actually do this for other bundles, like SU4, SU5, with Wilson lines that are equivariant, and you can actually produce three-family models with, let's say, one natural pair of heavy, of one naturally heavy family and two light ones. You can also get, I was looking at cubic terms, but if I look at cubic terms in matter, but if I look at quadratic terms, you actually get a texture in which you're allowed to grow back as vector-like pairs, which are also important. And I will just give you the results of this thing. Yukawa couplings, Miriam, can we compute them? Yes, we can in principle compute them. This, I think, is interesting for our field, though I'm not the one who is going to be able to do this. I would argue that people maybe should give it a try. Yukawa couplings are the triple cohomology product. What you have to do is get a sheaf cohomology, find a class representing your particle, and it always has a harmonic representative, so you're going to get some differential equation that you can solve, harmonic differential equation. This should be twisted with the gauge background. That's where it gets hard. And you ought to be able to solve for the zero modes. You should find them. Stick them in your computer, take the cubic product, find the metric, and take and multiply that, it'll give you a number. We can compute this number, and I'm not going to show you how to be sure, but you start out trying to find the metrics. This is based on work of Douglas and company, and then Douglas and the Penn group expanded that out. And let me just show you some Calabi-Yau's. If I look on a Fermat quintic, we can actually compute the metric on a Fermat quintic. And what we do, instead of looking at the metric because it's disgusting in the form that it's in, we look at an error measure. We say, how close does the Kähler form that you get from that metric that we've computed get to the 3-0, exact 3-0 form of the Calabi-Yau? This thing should go to zero, this error measure, as we're getting closer and closer to the Calabi-Yau metric. And so I show you the computer plots of this thing, and you can see that that error is quickly enough going down to zero. And so, in fact, stored in our computer really is the Calabi-Yau metric on a quintic, and we can do that a lot more than quintics. We can do it when there's isometries acting. We can do it on the heterotic standard models. We can do it always. So knowing numerically what a Calabi-Yau metric is solved. What about gauge bundles on top of these things? So this is more recent work with Laura and Volker Braun and Bobby Karp. And you essentially do the same thing, but now you're looking for the connection. So here's an example of this. There is an error message for the connection. This error should approach zero if the bundle is stable. And it will not approach zero if it's not stable. And then there's the really stupid thing of semi-stable, which doesn't approach zero, but can get closer to it. So here's some results, real honest results on Calabi-Yau backgrounds on a quartic K3, and we have it on others. And we're looking at different bundles, and there is a stable bundle. So we have the connection in there. We actually have an equal 1 connection solves the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, and there it is, that's its error message. These guys would be unstable. So we can get the connection. There's one on a threefold. So we had a bundle of, I forgot what it is already, on a threefold, and there it is, converging. So not only can you find a metric on Calabi-Yau's, you can find the connections that solve the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equation on Calabi-Yau's. They're disgusting, they're expansions in sections, higher holomorphic sections, and blah, blah, blah. So you don't want to look at them, but the computer knows them, okay? So the last piece to finding Yukawa couplings is to solve Laplace's equation for the zero modes. We've only done it without a vector field, that is the scalar Laplacian. So we can give a numerical way of finding solution of the scalar Laplacian, and we get beautiful answers here. So these are going to be the various eigenlevels of that Laplacian. Now, when we turn on the background, we want to look for zero modes. But without a background, we just want to see if we can find the eigenvalues. Not only do we find all these eigenvalues, it's utterly non-trivial, this thing. But I can match this against the group theory on a Calabi-Yau. Calabi-Yau doesn't have a continuous group, but it has finite groups. This has particular finite groups. We find their representations, and these stupid things are exactly the representations of those finite groups. So we also know how to do a scalar Laplacian. So to kind of get where you're heading, Miriam, we can take this, we can find the connection on it, which we did. What we have to do now is stick the connection into the Laplacian and find the zero modes, take them, take their qubit product, integrate them over the square root of g, which we know, and that will tell us what the Yukawa coupling is. So, and that's it. So let's see what else I got here. Heterotic cosmology. There's a lot of cosmology you get here, but I'm going to quit.
The issue is whether the metric, right, the telemetric, has some very special behavior. Otherwise,
Ricci flat.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about, you know, the killer potential. You need killer potential and you need super potential to be able to calculate physically Yukawa.
Yeah. So if you're going to bring up the normalization of the kinetic energy, yeah, that's true. One has
to do that.
Yes, that can also be, that also can be done numerically. No. Basically, there's two pieces. One of them is calculate the coupling parameters, which are these lambdas, which are the ones that you were complaining about before. And the second one,
the second one
is that you have to normalize the kinetic energy. And Mike Douglas and collaborators showed already how they can compute these Kähler metrics on Kähler space, and we're extending them to this case. Now, I'm not going to say that we can do this, and the reason is, and I've missed it already, I would like to point out to people here who are literate in this business, which I totally am not, but Laura and James and so on are, that there's this is at the cutting edge of computer science and parallel processing. And there's Singular, there's Macaulay, there's String Vacua, there's various programs, all of which have to be completely upgraded so that it can handle these problems. And these problems, I think, are incredibly concrete for our business and could really calculate parameters on Calabi-Yau's for the effective low-energy Lagrangian. I know that computer science people are really interested in this, and then people like James and Laura, who really know a lot of computer things, have done a lot with this, but it hasn't been all put together into a package where one could really compute things in heterotic theory. I would urge anybody here who's got those interests to think about this, because you really can get results. Bottom line, I appreciate being able to talk to you, and I hope this was helpful. Thanks. No.
I just wanted to ask in response to Miriam's last point. And one thing that's really cool about being able to do these numeric approximations to the connection and the metric is that it gives you a new tool for sifting the model. So, you know, if you write down some random heterotic model, yeah, the couplings are going to be totally wrong. I mean, you're not going to get the electron mass right. But maybe you learn something profound about how this structure works. It's very exciting to be able to explore.
I understand this is quantitative determination. I was more talking just about physical identification, whether this coupling is there at a classical level or not. And for that, you just use algebraic geometry. You need the triple product of certain homologies mapped into C number.
Right. Sure.
This is the first thing you have to determine, whether you have coupling or not. This is more detailed numerical quantitative determination of this coupling, right? But if it passes this first test, because there is a map, you know there is a coupling, right? Now it's an issue how to quantify it.
But Miriam, I got to point out to you that the only time that one knows how to decide whether there is a cubic coupling in cohomology is when you have some very strong principle, such as double array decomposition, which allows you to do it. We were never able to do it in any base except the DP9, which is a Lipschitz fiber. So it's one thing to say, well, you just get these cubic things. It's really, really hard to do that. So in the case you worked on with Rondinelli, you can do it.
But it's
a real problem.
No, you see, I have not, well, maybe, you know, it's not, it's just an issue of when you have classical couplings, you pass this first test, if you have technology to determine this first, then you do more detailed quantitative analysis, which is extremely hard, right, what you are after. But if it passes the first test, you're in generic ballpark of couplings, right? And we know those couplings are classical. They have to be of order one.
Yeah.
Unless you, when you do this numerical thing and you go to some special corners of moduli space and metric degenerates or something very weird happens, right? To tune such coupling that is generically of order one, to something that will give you 10 to the minus 3 electron volt neutrino mass.
I'm just talking about the issue
of mapping small neutrino masses from classical couplings. It is, in principle, I think, very hard thing.
Certainly, generically, you don't know until you work out the numbers.
To get 10 to the minus 7, you have a couplings will involve some very special fine-tuning of the model. Whatever.
Well, that's the electron, and no model that I've ever seen in my long, shabby career has ever shown how to get 10 to the minus 6. These things are really hard, so we shouldn't have to show any supergravity model. You just put in your calicum. String theory does give you the possibility, either this way or other ways, in which you might be able to compute them. Instantons, this direct calculations this way, which have to do with moduli at the end of the day. But that's all you can say. You can't, you know, I don't know
there are other ways of viewing it, right? As you well know, right?
Like
you
what?
Can perturbatively have only one coupling, right? Only the top. The rest is generated by instantons, and that's one way of getting hierarchy.
And maybe the hierarchy works. Does it work?
Classical level.
Does it work?
Well, we have conditions under which it works, right?
That's
that are not inconsistent.
That's good. So
no, anyway, I mean, this we are discussing general things. I hope you'll let me express my opinion, right?
I certainly have.
Right.
I certainly have, but let me express mine.
No, if you are predicting LHC prediction in a model, when you know that it's going to be very, very hard to get all the textures working in detail.
Masses
are at the classical level.
So in every theory that I've ever been involved with, always in a standard model, right up until the end of until we started doing instantons, nobody knew how to compute the Ulam mass, the tau on it. They just don't know how to do it.
That's what you're talking about.
I'm talking about it too. And I'm saying that we can get textures, we show how to get textures. These are classical things. Some of them could be small because they're developing in higher order operators, which is suppressed by some depth over a mass. They may or may not be small because you have to stabilize moduli in order to do that. And the fact is that they don't have to be one. They're just non-perturbative. Now, I don't like the fact that I put in 10 to the minus 9 for Yukawa coupling without some understanding. So people always try to build seesaw mechanisms. I applaud that. Be that as it may, you cannot do that in the exact MSSM. That in itself is an interesting question. You have to modify it in order to get a seesaw. And then, okay, but even then you don't get muon mass.
Maybe a comment.
No.
I think phenomenologically, a nice way of getting hierarchies is this program yields a mechanism.
Mm-hmm. It's which, sir?
The program yields a mechanism.
Yeah.
That means you generate, you have, say, one renormalizable coupling, which is a top quark, and then you generate the others
right.
by a higher dimensional operator. Right. Now, in the orbital constructions, you can see how that can happen in mm-hmm. principle. Something like that should then also be possible here.
I don't know if you could see how I don't know.
Now, aren't these stability avoidance very similar to this program using?
Yeah, I think they are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a new you want up here at a certain point, and then you somehow break it slightly. And you have just
the only downside, of course, is I completely agree with everything you just said, but the only downside of it is there's no real reason why the VEV would be small, which is, of course, necessary if you want this new mechanism.
No reason.
Well, you would just need why? To do the moduli stabilization. You need to get yeah.
to
the
everybody that. Has to know, of course, why it's better or smaller.
Let me make a comment there. But I don't know how to do that. But here's what we did in the thing that I showed you. Okay, we picked tan beta and mu. We then, once we know tan beta, we know up and down beds. We put in the experimental values for the Yukawa couplings at low energy and ran them back because we had to know what they were at high scale so that then I could use them to run other things down. They were boundary values that entered other things. But when you do that, you find some weird split pattern. They're not coming from a unified lambda. They're not generating out of the top. There's just some pattern that you get.
But Andy, these neutrino Yukawa couplings completely enriched before your analysis? I think all...
Neutrino.
Yeah, but everything in P minus L coupling is already, right? This is what drives your the mass squared negative, but not the neutrino Yukawa.
All I'm saying is that if we look for a unifying principle at high scale that could at low scale split and give us a observable spectrum, and we don't see any obvious unifying principle up there. Now, it could be that things all generate from common Yukawa mass. It could be that there are different classes of common Yukawa masses. There could be something else. All I can say is just anecdotally, we don't see any obvious mechanism that organizes those. So we've just input the experimental values given tan beta. And that's what all these calculations are based on. It seems clear enough. Now, it is true, I have no explanation for why the masses of quarks, quarks and leptons are what they are. And maybe it is true that one can generate these from instantons. Maybe if we did this numerically, and we do the whole thing, and we find the metric as well, and we go to various Calabi-Yaus and look in the right region of parameter space and show that the potentials are minimized at those points, I'd be able to give you a theory for these things. And that could happen. But I think a priori to worry that we didn't do it yet, I think is premature.
Okay. Thank you.
Don't forget to sign up for the dinner today on the weekend.